I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Urban redevelopment has been fun to watch over the past decade. Surprising projects are popping up everywhere, and our guests today are behind some of the most interesting. Eve Picker is transforming Pittsburgh's long-ignored downtown buildings into stylish residences and offices, setting the stage for future residential development in the heart of that city. Gene Goodman was the very first investor in Boston's Jamaica Plain co-housing, where she now lives. It's an unusual style of shared living with neighbors to fit today's busy lifestyles. We'll talk with Eve Picker and Gene Goodman about urban redevelopment today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Trained as an architect and urban designer, Eve Picker has built an entrepreneurial real estate development business called No Wall Productions in Pittsburgh. For the past decade, Eve has focused on downtown and urban neighborhoods that others have ignored, transforming vacant warehouses into loft-style residences and offices. Eve's real estate brokerage, We Do Property Management, now manages 220 residential units in 17 buildings. Last year, tired of waiting for others to trumpet the many good things happening in Pittsburgh, Eve launched an e-publication, PopCityMedia.com, aimed at breaking the bad news cycle so typical of Rust Belt cities, adding to Eve's all things urban mission. Pittsburgh was just named America's most livable city. Why?
Well, because it is. It is the most livable city. It's a great little city. It's got one of everything. It has dramatic and architecture and really fabulous neighborhoods that are quite distinct and different in style. It's very affordable, and it has a lot of very friendly people. So I think it really is a great place to live.
You've done your part to make Pittsburgh livable with your wonderful downtown reuse projects. What did you see in downtown Pittsburgh that others did not?
I'm not a Pittsburgher originally. I grew up in Australia, and I went to school in New York City. And I think people from the outside tend to see things that people who've grown up in a place don't. And so I saw these incredible buildings downtown that everyone was ignoring. And I think, you know, it's a small city, and it's a little behind in trends. And I suppose I couldn't believe that someone wouldn't want to live in them, just like I wanted to live in them. So I started developing them. It really wasn't anything more than that. I just saw something that the rest of the world was doing, and thought we could do it in Pittsburgh as well.
Do you think it typically takes an outsider to recognize potential?
I'm not sure if typical is fair. It might be typical in Pittsburgh. It's because it's small. I think if you're in a larger city, that may not be the case. But you're less likely to. I think someone who's traveled and seen the rest of the world can also understand what's possible.
Downtown living has taken off in a lot of unlikely places. Why do people want to live downtown now?
I think there are lots of reasons. I personally wanted to live downtown because I always wanted to live in a very urban environment above a store, be able to walk everywhere, and I've never really been interested in a suburban lifestyle. And even neighborhoods in the city, I tended to have to get into my car to go places. So I think, you know, it's almost the way I was born. I'm a very urban creature and really enjoy living a lifestyle like that. I think add to that the greening of America, and that people are beginning to understand the cost of forever building outside the city, the cost of owning a vehicle, the cost of time, which is, you know, one of the big reasons for me to live this way. I don't want to commute. It's the most horrible thing I can think of. What a waste of my time. So I think people are beginning to understand the cost to their lives and to everyone's lives when they don't find some sustainable way to live.
But do you think people previously wanted to live this way and just didn't have the option to do so? Or is this a new phenomenon?
I think there are people who've wanted to live like that, and there was no product. And unfortunately, in Pittsburgh, it's still very early days, and so we have very limited type of product. It seems to be mostly very expensive units. I think there's a whole segment of the market that would love to live downtown and can't afford it. And I hope the city is going to address this in the future. It will take a pretty strategic plan to make that happen. The biggest problem Pittsburgh has is an economic one, because you can live 2 miles from the heart of downtown in a house that you can purchase for $75,000. So for a developer to build something new in the heart of downtown and compete with that is very, very tough. In a sense, the wonderful amenities, living amenities that the city has makes it tougher.
How many projects have you completed?
Oh, I always have to count. I think it's about 12. 12 pretty small ones. They're not huge. The smallest is a two-unit building, and the largest is about 40,000 square feet.
And what has their impact been?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure I can answer that. I think you might have to ask someone else. My projects are kind of very organic and small, and their impact has been incremental. I've done 5 buildings downtown now, so I've seen buildings on streets that I've tackled where neighbors have invested where they hadn't invested before. So it's almost a Main Street approach.
What are the biggest challenges to be overcome when developing in any downtown?
Well, the very biggest challenge is the economic one I talked about before, that Pittsburgh has an amazing array of housing and living amenities that are very inexpensive. So it's a very big challenge to create a new market that has to be more expensive simply because of the cost of building. That, I think, is the very biggest challenge. Early on, the challenges also included local bankers who couldn't quite believe that anyone would ever want to live in downtown Pittsburgh. But those challenges have faded a little bit. I think there's a lot of people on board now. Now there are smaller challenges. That's not absolutely true. One of the very big challenges that remains is the one I alluded to before, and that is, how do you create an array of housing for a diverse population so that you can really create a neighborhood? And to create affordable housing downtown, it's going to have to be heavily subsidized, and that's probably the biggest challenge right now. Along with that, there are a bunch of smaller challenges. Dumpsters being emptied at 3 a.m. are very disturbing. But you have a city with 2 lives, people who want to sleep at night and businesses that need to function in the day. How do you deal with parking issues where very small buildings, it becomes pretty impossible to try and park inside a building, so you've got to find alternative ways to deal with that for your tenants or buyers. How do you get small amenities going in downtown? Dry cleaners, grocery stores. A grocery store in the heart of Pittsburgh has been talked about now for 5 years, and we still don't have one. I don't mean a really big grocery store, but somewhere where you could buy fresh fruit and meat. There are all those sorts of little challenges to sort of start forming these projects that have happened into a real neighborhood.
How can the retail sector in downtown be jump-started?
Oh, that's a really tough question. It's been tried a number of ways. There are a big jump-start projects, like right in the middle of downtown. There's a 5th and Forbes project, but both the state and the city are going to be involved in helping some large retailers. They've tried that in the past and it hasn't succeeded because there's not a consistent enough population day and night to support those businesses. It's kind of a circular problem. You need more people living there. You need more people there in the daytime to be able to support retail businesses. But it's harder to get people to live there without those sorts of retail businesses. So it's a very gradual process. There are organizations like the Downtown Partnership in Pittsburgh that try to tackle this. It would be great to have a little program for small businesses that want to start. I don't think anyone in the city is thinking about that, but boost a couple of key businesses that would really help the neighborhood, so to speak. And if someone wants to take the risk and start them, help them somehow.
And what would those be?
I think there's a couple of key ones. One is fresh fruit and meat, somehow, small market. Another one is food delivery. Another one might be doggy daycare. A lot of people who live downtown have pets. You can never have enough dry cleaners. That's the first thing that everyone looks for. We have a great one starting in Pittsburgh. It's being announced next week that the program's actually starting, and that's the Flex Car program, which would really allow, I think there's only a couple of cities in this country that have it, and that would really allow you to live downtown without a vehicle. It's a fabulous program, and I plan to get rid of my car. A gas station would be huge. There isn't any nearby. You really have to think about where to get gas when you don't have any left. You know, there's a lot of very high-end restaurants, and there's a lot of very cheap ones like Subway and pizza stores. But I'd love to see a bunch of cheap good eats like noodle bowl shops emerge for people who want something less expensive at night when they're living there. You can never have enough sidewalk cafes. We don't ever have enough of those. Maybe a movie theater. We currently have an arts movie theater. It would be really great to have a first-run movie theater, even a small one. Some lifestyle stores, some hip shopping stores, all of those things I think would be pretty fabulous to have.
I want to talk a minute about Pop City. For our listeners who haven't seen it, describe Pop City.
Well, Pop City is another one of my business ventures in partnership with a group in Detroit. It's an e-magazine that is published weekly, and its mission really is to change the conversation about Pittsburgh. I think I would be a very happy person if I were to be able to travel in a couple of years and talk to someone about Pittsburgh, and instead of getting a reaction which is something like, ooh, Pittsburgh, smoke, stack, steel, stuff like that. I'd love to be able to get a reaction which is, wow, I've heard a lot of things are changing there. It sounds like a fabulous city. So what we talk about in Pop City is we write feature stories every week, two or three feature stories, and they are written with some basic indicators in mind, and they're called the TIDE indicators. TIDE stands for Talent, Innovation, Diversity, and Environment. And apparently cities that have high TIDE indicators are cities that young people want to go to. So our mission really is to talk about those things. Those are things that are happening in Pittsburgh. We're not making them up. There's plenty to write about. We have a story list as long as my arm. And we write those stories every week. In addition, we write 6 to 8 development news stories to give a sense of investment momentum. And again, there's plenty to write about. We write 6 to 8 innovation news stories about research, job growth, other innovations every week, and there's plenty to write about there. And we do that every week with, along with some pretty fabulous photography about Pittsburgh, which again would make you look at it and think this isn't the Pittsburgh I think about. And we send it out. And we've been publishing now for a year, and started the first month with about 20,000 unique visitors to our website. A year later, we're over 90,000 and growing at a nice clip of at least 20%. A month. So it's going out everywhere at the moment. I think probably our biggest readership is still in Pittsburgh, but we know we have readers all over the country and all over the world. Just today, I got a correction comment from someone in Australia.
Why weren't these stories being told?
You know, traditional media is not really geared towards talking about the good news. I think their role is to report on breaking news every day. And I think too often they forget about a mix. So when you look at a traditional newspaper like the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, you're going to maybe not get the whole picture about Pittsburgh. You'll get today's news, international news and local news. And reporters are trained to write certain news before they write good news, and that is probably fires and rapes and all the things that we read about every day. So if there's a company or a person who's thinking about moving to a city and they pick up that newspaper, they're not really going to get a great opinion of the city. And so our mission is really to provide an alternative or to work in synergy with traditional news. We won't report on fires and the number of cars stolen this week. It's just not what we do. We report on someone who's moved to the city and is doing amazing things, or some investment that's been made in a neighborhood, or someone opening up a new restaurant, or 200 units being built downtown. That's the sort of thing that we report about.
How do you keep it, Eve, from being happy talk? How do you balance good news and the kinds of things that people tend to gravitate toward?
I think the team in Pittsburgh is not a boring team, and we're not really into happy talk. It's not hard because we're really reporting on things that are going on. We're not making any of this up. So it really is reporting. It's just reporting about different type of stories. We all love the city. We have a fabulous managing editor. We have a particular tone that we try and achieve in every story, and it's just something that we work on.
Eve, do you think most cities have an opportunity to tell a different, more positive, more compelling story about themselves?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think too often people don't even understand the city they live in. What's nice about Pop City is that we organize all the stories and all the assets by neighborhood. So all those stories that we write are archived in each neighborhood. So a visitor coming into the city could just look at one section of the website and get a great overview of that particular neighborhood. So it's offering an opportunity for locals to read it, for people who are coming in to read it, for businesses to use it as an HR tool. A lot of businesses have a lot of problem convincing people to move to Pittsburgh, and we would like to change that. I'm a real estate developer, and I started doing this not because I really planned it, but because I really got fed up with the fact that, first of all, I need a few more hot bodies in Pittsburgh for my business to stay in business. All of us do. And I just need a little growth. And I got very tired of city leadership and newspapers taking the lead and telling that story. And when I was presented with this opportunity, I took it for those reasons, that I felt like the city had so much to offer, so many amazing things going on, and no one was really connecting the dots.
You've developed buildings in downtown. You've started Pop City. What's next for you?
Who knows? I feel like I'm only just beginning. There's always something interesting around the corner.
Eve Picker is president of No Wall Productions in Pittsburgh. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Inspiration for ways to improve our cities and communities can come from many sources. We've talked with urban leaders, designers, corporate CEOs, planners, architects, and others about innovative responses to the challenges so many of our nation's cities face. This week, Business Week magazine's innovation and design writer, Rena Janna, weighs in with what she sees as on the cutting edge of business and technology and how these ideas may influence the smart city.
You've heard the hype surrounding Second Life. It's the online 3D parallel universe that's the darling of corporations ranging from Toyota to IBM. These companies have been experimenting with selling digital goods and conducting meetings among avatars within Second Life. It's where 5 million virtual residents around the world spend real dollars for digital real estate. They also buy pixelated cars and clothing that they design and sell themselves. Or they customize and purchase goods from companies such as Reebok and American Apparel. It's also an online environment that's become notorious for vandalism and adult-themed content, not to mention technical glitches and hackers. But Second Life isn't the only virtual community worth paying attention to. This year, a number of new alternatives are starting to crop up. They promise more secure and specialized environments for consumers and corporations alike. One virtual world that we've been paying attention to is Kineva. It's currently free in an open beta. The company wants to attract large mainstream audiences, and it has really easy-to-use design tools, graphics that load quickly, and safety features that keep out cybercriminals. In real estate terms, Kineva is the digital suburbs to Second Life's more urban environment. Currently, Kineva has 150,000 plus beta users. That's up from 115,000 in March 2007 and nearly double the 80,000 users in December 2006. Kineva is generating some early buzz thanks to its focus on social networking and security. Similar to MySpace, Kineva allows for friend requests, comments, email among members, and profiles via a two-dimensional customized web page. And like Second Life, Kineva also offers animated 3D characters that users design and manipulate through on-screen environments in real time. So users can also upload music, images, and video and play streaming media within these virtual environments. But what sets Kineva apart is its current level of supervision from its parent company. The entire virtual world is aesthetically controlled by Kineva's software. What that means is that users can't design their own buildings, clothing, or vehicles from scratch. And they can't hire a developer to design virtual products. In Kineva, people currently choose an existing design for the virtual apartment and human avatars. But in Second Life, residents can buy islands and create wacky avatars and environments. So the question we've been asking is how Kineva is going to make money. One model the company has shared with us is brand sponsorship of digital products. Kineva may also charge users who want to upgrade the free apartments, furniture, and avatar clothes. And then there's a licensing opportunity. Currently, Kineva gives away its software to companies, and there's been about 40,000 downloads to date. So it's no surprise that Kineva offers a secure environment. It's the brainchild of Christopher Klaus, who founded Internet Security Systems in 1994 while a student at Georgia Tech. IBM bought the computer security company for $1.3 billion last year, providing Klaus with plenty of seed capital for Kineva. So Kineva isn't the first company to offer an alternative to Second Life that merges social networking with a 3D online universe. There's Cyworld, which originated in Korea, but now has an American version. Its graphics are more cartoon-like than those of Kineva or Second Life. Cyworld is basically a social networking site that also offers online environments that users outfit with avatars and digital furniture and goods. Some of them are co-branded with popular TV shows, such as Bravo Network's Top Design. And Linden Lab, the company behind Second Life, is constantly launching new applications to keep fans loyal to the virtual world. For example, Linden Lab recently introduced a sound feature that allows Second Life residents' voices to be heard within the virtual world. Kineva is still a work in progress. Although the 3D avatars look eerily similar to those in Second Life, some of the animation isn't quite as sophisticated. For example, avatars can't sit in a chair in the current beta version. But Klaus says Kineva should be finished with an animation system upgrade by early May. Other 3D virtual worlds we're looking into include Tixio, a maker of corporate virtual world software used by customers including defense contractor Raytheon. In Tixio, users conduct meetings among executive avatars in a secure environment only available to invited guests. Another is Quack, a startup that also offers avatar-based online corporate offices and meeting rooms. Quack uses engaging light, music, and color cues to highlight documents being discussed. To find a file, you simply say its name, like Business Week article on new virtual worlds. And then avatars appear in a corresponding 3D room. And another virtual world that's worth checking out is Multiverse. It's best for small businesses and individuals interested in creating their own virtual worlds without much financial commitment. Its tools are available for free. But if you create digital goods, such as clothing, and sell them to other avatars, Multiverse takes a 10% cut of your profits. So clearly, Second Life isn't alone in the ever-expanding realm of virtual worlds. There's a second wave of 3D parallel universes out there for a variety of corporate and consumer experimentation, just waiting to be visited.
Rena Janna is innovation and design writer for Business Week. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
The recent collapse of a portion of a freeway interchange in the San Francisco Bay Area has put transportation planning in the spotlight. Many feared congestion would skyrocket after the interchange collapse, but to their surprise, traffic after the accident turned out to be just as good as before, if not better. According to the Caltrans Freeway Performance Management System, traffic was considerably lighter in the days following the freeway's collapse, by 11, 15, and even 22%. Transportation engineers are touting that decreasing the amount of drivers on the road by only about 10% can show huge improvements in traffic flow. And it seems that many of those drivers who stayed away from the freeway took advantage of free rides on BART, the Bay Area's commuter train system, which posted record ridership the day after the collapse. And San Francisco has joined a host of other U.S. cities and even more international cities in creating a temporary car-free zone in one of its urban parks. The city plans to close a mile of road in Golden Gate Park every Saturday this summer, providing much-needed open space to the dense city's cyclists and pedestrians. The Christian Science Monitor reports that, aside from San Francisco, an increasing amount of American cities are proposing pedestrian-friendly, car-free zones in their public parks. Among them, New York, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Chicago, and Cleveland. These American examples draw their inspiration from a program started in Bogota, Colombia in 1983, which closes off the city's streets to cars every Sunday. That program brings more than 1 million people out to the city's streets each week and has been recognized internationally for its success. And while those urban areas are looking for ways to provide open spaces for their steadily growing populations, the former industrial city of Youngstown, Ohio, may have found a way to deal with its steadily declining population. City planners and local officials have decided to actually embrace the population decline by setting up a plan to allow their town to shrink. The Wall Street Journal reports that Youngstown will let declining areas continue to decline, with the hopes of eventually demolishing underutilized buildings and streets to create rural and open spaces. Officials are going to devise plans for each of the town's 127 neighborhoods to determine which can be thinned out, which can be turned to open space, and which should be preserved as is. For PlanetiZen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanetiZen. After a short break, we'll talk about co-housing in Boston with Gene Goodman. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. Gene Goodman was the earliest investor in Boston's Jamaica Plain co-housing, where she has lived since 2005. The following year, she joined Eco Developments and helped start Eco Village, a new co-housing project underway in Boston. Gene, explain the concept of co-housing.
Co-housing is essentially a neighborhood for people who want real neighbors. So I think the best way to describe co-housing is compared to what I had before I lived in co-housing, where I lived on a street where people could drive down the street, pull into their driveway just far enough so they could reach into their mailbox, bring their mail in their car, zoom into their garage, never to be seen again. So co-housing is where everyone knows each other and everyone wants to be able to be good neighbors.
And how is that achieved?
It's achieved primarily because of the design of the building and the desire of the people. So as far as the design is concerned, there are a lot of things that are designed to allow people to interact with each other. Pedestrian pathways, very conscious placement of things so that you are going to run into your neighbors. So parking is typically, for example, clustered off to the side. So you meet people to and from parking. You meet people to and from picking up your mail. We like to joke that the trip from your parking lot to your house takes about 45 minutes and two beers. As far as the desire is concerned, we're talking about people who are choosing to be neighbors, people who want to be able to interact with each other. So for example, when my TV blew up and I decided to buy another TV, I had to borrow a friend's car. So I went to talk to her, found her at another friend's house drinking a glass of wine. Yeah, I'm giving you the impression that everything is about alcohol. It isn't. But so I asked her if I could borrow her car. Instead, she gave me one of her extra televisions, a glass of wine, and a plate of lasagna. We were there till 10:30.
Tell me how co-housing is organized. I mean, who designs it? Who develops it? Does it become a problem with getting it through the typical city approvals? And then how are the people who live there chosen? Because you're talking about a very intentional community, and I'm kind of curious how that comes into being.
Well, typically, co-housing is designed by the future residents. The people who started our community said, I love this concept. I want it in Boston, and I need to start gathering some people around me. So they started talking to friends. They started putting around flyers saying, who else is interested in doing this with us? Then a bunch of us started to get together. We started asking for who else was going to be interested in this. It's a very self-selecting process where people who want this kind of neighborhood, they get together. As far as the city's cooperation, the city basically treated us as though we were any other kind of developer until they saw what we had made. The mayor of Boston, Mayor Menino, is very, very excited about what we've created and has made it very clear to us that he is very interested in seeing more communities like this for various reasons, among them being the security in the neighborhood, the conscientious attitude that the residents have, as well as the strides that our group made towards making things as affordable as possible and as inclusive as possible. Our group never said that someone couldn't join us. It was always a self-selecting process where people who wanted to be involved in this were the kinds of people who sought us out.
Interesting. Did any of you have development experience?
We didn't. And in fact, that's one of the things that has inspired me to go further with this into another group called Eco Developments, which is creating more co-housing now that there is a specific development experience. It was a whole lot harder on us since we didn't have developers. We were lay people making lay people's mistakes. And I think it would have been a whole lot easier if we had been able to have a developer work with us.
Did the lay people's mistakes wind up with costing more money, costing more time, a design that you think could have been better? Where were the mistakes made?
The mistakes were made primarily with time and money. We were talking about people who didn't have experience, who were trying to figure out things as they were going along, stumbling in the dark. Mind you, there are a lot of other people who have been involved in co-housing who have been able to give us advice along the way. But I think it's much easier if you have someone who you can hire who's already experienced with that to take control. So I do think that it cost us some time and money.
How long did it take you, Jean, to get organized?
Well, it all depends on where you start the timeline. There were two failed groups before ours got underway. So from the founder's perspective, it took 10 years. From my perspective, it took 5, which is from the point at which we hired our project manager until the point at which we moved in.
Wow, 5 years. That's a long time. And people's lives change during 5 years or certainly a decade. Did you lose people along the way? You must have.
We did lose some people, and some of them were really painful to lose, and we lost people for a variety of reasons. Some was, you know, we had one family who ended up moving to the Washington area, and we had some people who ended up saying, you know what, I don't think I can afford it any longer. But I would say for the most part, the people who we had three-quarters of the way through it are the people who are still there now.
And what does the ownership structure at Jamaica Plain Co-Housing in Boston look like? Do you own your homes outright? Do you own shares in an overall development? How does it work?
Legally, we're a condo association.
Okay.
And we own our own unit and then a share of the common space, depending upon the size of our unit.
Mm-hmm. And do you pay a monthly dues like a condo association would do to operate and maintain the common space?
We do, with one important difference, which is that we don't hire a management company. We do the management ourselves, which also means that we do our own upkeep. And one of the things that's always a point of discussion, in fact, a big salon coming up this week for it, is how do we make the work structure fair? We all agreed to work 4 hours per month on maintaining the community.
And is that stipulation not being met?
I would say most largely it is. There are some times that we find that there are people who either aren't reporting their hours, but they are working, or people who aren't getting all of their hours in. And we're trying to figure out how to make certain that everything is done in a fair way. One of the biggest questions that we have is a big part of co-housing is being able to get together for common meals once in a while, Typically, you have your own meals in your own house, but a few days a week, it's nice to get together and have a meal as a party. It's a completely voluntary thing. But we would like to make it, some of us would like to make it so that the cooks can claim the hours that they work as part of their work hours, the time that they're putting into cooking. But the way it's structured at the moment, it's not added into your work hours. If we add those hours to the total work hours, all of us will have to raise the hours that we have per month.
At Jamaica Plain Co-Housing, you set out to create a multi-generational mixed-income community. Have you achieved that goal?
Tremendously. I am so proud of the fact that our residents range from age 2 to, well, somewhere in their 80s. And we have people with a wide variety of financial situations and family situations. And among the things that I'm pleased with is that there are 6 different native languages spoken within our community of only 30 households.
What are the advantages in your mind of having a multi-generational mixed income community?
I think the main advantage is that we all come from different points of view. And by having a variety of different incomes, it gives us a different perspective. When we are faced with a economic challenge, we say, well, what do you think we should do with this? And we get a whole lot more viewpoints than we would if we were all the same type of people. I think it makes us a whole lot more responsible.
Who decides what is communally shared among the neighbors at Jamaica Plain?
The group did. We make all of our decisions by consensus. And a lot of times what happens is we'll get together and we'll say, how do we want to utilize this space, especially during the design period? What should this space be? And we talk about it. Do we want it to be a playroom? Do we want it to be an exercise room? If so, how are we going to get the materials that are going to go in there? One of the things that tends to happen a great deal because of the nature of the people in this group is there's a lot of donations that happen. So within about a week or two of moving in, suddenly a ping pong table appeared in our rumpus room. Don't know who it came from, but boy, is it used a lot.
I'm curious in terms of the comparison you made between co-housing and a condo association. And certainly a number of condo associations don't have management, professional management. They are self-managed. Are there other fundamental differences that between a condo association and co-housing? I'm trying to understand where those differences might lie, or is this another name for a very common concept?
Well, I do think that there are some condo associations that border on co-housing because people are so much in touch with one another and so friendly to one another. But I think among the responsibilities of a co-housing association is that the entire membership is supposed to be involved in the decisions and functioning of the operations. We don't leave everything to a board. In fact, just last night we had our general meeting and we had probably about 90% attendance where we're discussing everything from repairs that need to be made to the building to what happens in case of a fire.
Mm. You mentioned that you are also involved now in eco-developments to make development of co-housing easier for the next group. Tell me about that project.
Well, it's Eco-Developments is a company that is working on getting co-housing built all over, but primarily we're focusing on the Northeast. And our project that we are most interested in at the moment is called Eco-Village at JP, which is actually going to be right down the street from Jamaica Plain Co-Housing and already has 6 committed households. What is going to be unique about that project is it's not only going to be co-housing, it's also going to be green and mixed use, which means that there's going to be a commercial entity to it as well. And we're really looking forward to seeing how we can get the commercial entities to work along with the residents to create even more community. So they might be sharing some spaces amongst them. One of the commercial entities that is interested in the space is also looking for some performance space, which might be terrific performance space for the co-housing group to use for their talent shows. Hmm. There also is going to be a group that most likely that is a daycare, which I expect a lot of the residents will probably be very excited to have available.
Are these projects hard to finance?
That's a really good question. One of the things that is really terrific is that we have had great fortune with financial institutions. Wainwright supported Jamaica Plain co-housing in a wonderful way, Wainwright Bank. And because of their experience, they've now been able to make other banks in the area less worried about funding something like this. So one of the groups that I've been working with recently was able to get their construction loan in their unique way, partially because of the experience that Jamaica Plain Co-Housing had with Wainwright in the past.
What are the aspects of eco-developments and your newest project, Eco-Village, that makes them sustainable?
Well, there's going to be sustainable building materials. There's going to be as many green materials and energy-saving methods of construction and design as possible. And the other thing also that I believe really strongly is that community itself is something that needs to be a sustainable product.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the more we can connect with each other, the better off we are as a society. We work together towards keeping things safe, keeping things clean, keeping things, keeping people connected to one another. Everything from, you know, having someone who's willing to walk your dog when you can't make it home in time to making certain that that person looking in your window is something you, someone you know.
And when you think about the siting of Eco-Village or your eco-developments that you anticipate putting throughout the Northeast, do you think about the larger context of sustainability, in other words, where they're located, their access to transit, their existence on or their siting on existing infrastructure, things like that?
Oh, tremendously. One of the major reasons that Eco-Village at JP is going to be located where it is because it is within sight distance of the Orange Line subway station here in Jamaica Plain. And we're expecting that probably a very large number of the members of the community and the people who are going to be going to the commercial entities won't need cars to get there and therefore reduce the impact on the world in many ways.
Mm-hmm. How big nationally is the co-housing movement?
I wish I had looked up the number before I came here, but I believe there are well over 100 communities now and many more already underway.
And was this a movement started elsewhere?
Yes, actually, it started in Denmark in the 60s and made it over to the United States. I believe that was in the 80s that it first landed here, and I believe the first community was in California.
Why do you think it's been so slow to take off?
Well, I think primarily because there is so much work involved. I think it is really hard for people to imagine putting their lives on hold for 3, 4, 5 years, working two jobs, essentially their own job, and then trying to get their community built. So for a lot of people, they hear about it, they say, well, that's an interesting idea, but I can't commit to something like that. I'm hoping now with if the concept of having a developer takes off as we expect it will, it'll make a really big difference about whether people will feel as though it's within reach.
When you think about who the market is for co-housing, can you describe it in any detail?
I think I can. I think that co-housing is really, really terrific for single people. As I mentioned, it's the type of thing where you can say, feed my fish while I'm gone, take care of my dog. I think it's really terrific for children because they're connected with other children in a very safe way. You don't have to plan play dates anymore. The children just go outside. I think it's really terrific for parents because you can contact a neighbor and say, I'm going to be late coming home. Can my kid come over to your house and hang out there until I can get there? I think it's really terrific for couples starting out because they have the support of their neighbors and their friends, people who will be there for them when they're going through all of the changes that they have. I think it's really terrific for people who are retired and maybe they're empty nesters, starting to see how life is going to change now that they don't have the responsibility of children, have a little bit more freedom. I think it's fabulous for seniors. They have the security of the neighbors. They have the relationships with people around them who are going to be looking out for them and making certain that, you know, if something is not right, that they're going to be there for them.
Well, Jean, I think you've just described the entire spectrum of the market.
I think that might be right.
Very clever as a would-be developer. let me slice in, though, here. I take it there's nothing in the charter, there's nothing in your mortgage, there's nothing that you sign on to in the association, if you will, that says you'll take care of the neighbor's dog or you'll feed the neighbor's fish or watch the neighbor's child. It's simply the intentionality of community that people bring to the idea of co-housing. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, all of that's completely voluntary. There are some people who live in my neighborhood now who I probably would not ask to feed our cat, and they wouldn't expect me to ask them, and that's really okay with everyone. And the only thing that is really expected of you that is different from other condo associations is to put in your work towards making the community function, the 4 hours of work in our case per month.
So that's really the only requirement. And is that typical in co-housing?
It is. I actually haven't heard of any co-housing community that doesn't require it at all. There are some communities where they actually will hire someone to do some of the work, but all communities have some kind of requirement to help build and maintain the community in one way or another, even if it's not physical labor.
When Mayor Menino looked at Jamaica Plain co-housing in his city of Boston, he liked it for lots of obvious reasons. He's thinking, it's going to be cheaper for me as mayor I'll have to deliver fewer services to these folks because they're going to keep their place clean and safe, and that's in their interest. Do you think he was looking at it also as a model for what he might do in other parts of the city, not necessarily through co-housing, but in terms of encouraging intentionality around community?
I don't know if he is going to necessarily try to make that happen, but he definitely has given us the impression that he's going to support us in making it happen. So Jamaica Plain Co-Housing actually just recently won his Residential Green Award for a green community.
That's
and,
exciting.
He was very clear to Patty Lautner, who was the person who received it for us, that he is very interested in Eco Village at JP, really wants to be able to recreate what happened in Jamaica Plain co-housing. And for all the reasons that you just mentioned, it makes good fiscal sense to the city. It makes good social sense. It makes good sense in so many ways.
Jean, I'll look forward to seeing your work in Boston, both at Jamaica Plain Co-Housing and your new work at Eco Village JP. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much. We'll be waiting to have our dinner with you.
Jean Goodman is a co-housing advocate with Eco Developments. Her newest project is Eco Village. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says sharing space with strangers on trains and planes can sometimes make you long for splendid isolation.
My flight out of LaGuardia the other night was delayed several hours. When we finally boarded, it was late at night. I dozed off as soon as I sat down, but since I was planning to do some work during the flight, I pulled my laptop out of my briefcase and held it in my lap. As our plane taxied to the end of the runway, I was awakened by a cold, wet spot spreading across my thigh. I opened my eyes and saw that the woman sitting next to me had spilled her soft drink while reaching to give her cup to the flight attendant before we took off. I started to blot my pants leg when I noticed that the left side of my laptop had taken the brunt of her spill. I feared the worst. An hour into the flight, I figured that my laptop had dried out, so I turned it on. It booted up fine for a minute before crashing and displaying that infamous IBM blue screen with an ominous error message about a hardware malfunction. My laptop computer was fried. The woman who had spilled her soft drink on my computer was beside herself apologizing to me. And there was a time in my life when this accident would have sent me over the edge. But that night, I just closed the lid on my laptop and wrote it off to fate. Besides, I blame myself, too. After all, if I hadn't been so overeager about pulling out my computer, it wouldn't have been in my lap in the first place. I don't know if there's a lesson in this story or not, but I do know that when I got home that night, I was glad I hadn't flown off the handle about my laptop. In the past, losing my temper, even with justification, had just made me feel worse, not better, about the situation at hand. In some cases, my anger had even compounded the situation. That night, I arrived home without the residual rage that used to keep me roiled up long after whatever had happened. It turned out that I was able to get a temporary laptop the next day and then a replacement a week later. But even if I had been left without a laptop for longer than that, I would have gotten by just fine. Of course, I don't know if I can always be this calm, but I'd like to be. I'd like to be the kind of person who always stays cool and collected, even when somebody spills something on my laptop. So I've decided that it would be helpful if we could take some deliberate steps to minimize the annoyances that nag at us every day and put us on edge. Maybe in this way, we could increase the odds that we would be able to keep our composure even when something unexpected happens. How about cars with two horns, one to say watch out and one to say excuse me or thank you? Why not movie theater snacks packaged in a silent candy wrapper? Why not cell phones with a sound meter to let us know when we're talking too loudly? Couldn't we teach rules for merging into one lane in driver's ed, just as we teach who has the right-of-way at a four-way stop? Shouldn't we air public service ads about the documented health benefits of forgiveness and gratitude? How about turning off radio and TV programs that entertain through the use of anger and insults? In short, if we really insisted, we could get the attention of community leaders and marketers. And we should, because anything we can do to give ourselves a better chance of keeping our cool is something worth doing. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for our podcast, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.